Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. As always, I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. Back from this long break with my two cohorts, there is Danny King, writer for The Film Stage.
Good to be back in business here.
Yeah, and then there's Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Sometimes you want raspberries, and after a while you want strawberry.
They are like flavors. So that's the new Hispanic man from a Terrence Malick film that you're going to start quoting?
Oh, well, Father Quintana is alive and well.
Good. Good.
Whether you like it or not.
Whether you like it or not. Oh, Jesus. A lot of stuff has happened in the time that we've been gone. We will be talking about some of it before we lead into our feature review, which will be of The Babadook, a new Australian psychological thriller, drama, horror, family film. That is
excellent, excellent.
Yeah, it's been burning up Twitter and those in the know for a while, and so we're going to talk about it. It's from writer-director Jennifer Kent, and it stars Essie Davis and Noah Wiseman. Before we get into that, like I said, we're going to be talking about a bunch of random stuff. I'd also like to just remind everyone to follow us on Twitter at The Film Stage Show. Email us with any questions or comments you may have at podcast@thefilmstage.com. And as always, you can comment on the posts that we post on thefilmstage.com, where these episodes are located. So there is a slew of ways to get in touch with us. As always, the best thing that we always ask for, comments and ratings on iTunes. So yeah, that's about it for catch up and clean up. So let's dive right into some news. What should we talk about first? Should we talk about the thing that we like, or the thing that's kind of a pain in the ass that we should just discuss because it's everywhere?
What is there to say about the thing that has received comments from the President of the United States that we could add to?
Wow, that's so well put.
Yeah. What could we say that has not already been said by George Clooney and Barack Obama?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's bigger than a trailer, obviously, but it's... It's also so ingrained into the fabric of American culture by now,
right,
that it's almost like it's bad. I mean, obviously it's bad, but
right. It's like the burning of the White House in 1812. It's like, you know, is there really anything we could add to the conversation?
I will say this. I, as someone who absolutely detests censorship in any form, I was more upset by the decision going on than I kind of expected. Like, it just kind of really weighed on me that whole day. In a way I really would not have expected.
Right.
I was having a pretty good day. It was actually my last full day on campus, you know. I could do a little drinking, I could eat a nice sandwich, hang out with friends. Mm-hmm. And it was just kind of bothering me all day in a way I wouldn't have expected. And I think that's, you know, it's because of obviously the precedent that it sets, the example it sets, what it says about the power that we give certain groups of people,
right,
for no good reason, or rather, more specifically, the idiocy that goes on with these kinds of decisions. I mean, the whole Sony hacks have revealed that the people running that company are not intelligent human beings, and I don't mean that. I don't mean that in
like
the sense
of the worst impulses you would have about that company.
And I don't mean that in the sense of they make bad movies mostly, which they do, but more that they actually come across as dumb human beings.
Right.
Just the emails, for instance, are very disconcerting, that someone who runs a major company kind of, you know, types like a third grader writing an email to their grandmother or something. Did you guys see Amy Pascal's email about the Cameron Crowe film that is not, apparently isn't coming together? It's just, it's lying. It's, well, you kind of have to get the full effect by actually looking at it,
okay,
but it's lined by, it's just one line for every, you know, 3 to 7 words. So it goes like, score same as last time and line, way worse in NY, line, it's a wrap, line, there's nowhere to do, line, Cameron never really changed anything, line, and it just goes on.
Bad formatting and, you know, like.
Yeah, and the last three lines are really incredible. It's, it never, not even once ever works.
Wow.
Which is like a really devastating.
That maybe she was going for like a tone poem.
Yeah, it's like beat poetry
yeah.
going on.
It might actually be kind of genius.
Granted, that the people who run a major studio are kind of dumb. I mean, that's one thing, but it's I don't know. The whole decision just there's no good that comes from it. Although
no.
I will say that it is fun, even if just momentarily, passingly, fleetingly, to revel in the spectacle of the President of the United States giving an official statement on a Seth Rogen and James Franco movie. Like, actually, and not only giving an official statement, but actually where it seems warranted, where it seems like there is a reason to say this because it becomes a matter of national security. I don't recall the last time I watched a news report that was genuinely surreal, like seeing the president saying why this Rogen Franco movie needs to be protected on the right side of the screen, while on the left side of the screen it is North Korea's military forces marching through Pyongyang and the midget child who runs that country on a boat waving on like a little motorboat that's about the size of like my uncle's like, you know, thing that he takes on the lake.
Right.
That was something else. And I really appreciated being there for that.
I mean, let's be real. Anytime that you see the diminutive dictator of that desolate, despotic dictatorship, it's always a surreal moment because you're just like, well, that is not 30 Rock. Like, this is real life. You know, we're not doing this to have like an oafish, amiable looking dictator in a movie. Like, that's the dude. To have him apparently wielding so much power as to what we will be seeing this Christmas is it's pretty weird. I had no interest in seeing this movie, but I agree with you, Nick. To borrow a couple of political phrases, this is a slippery slope that will have a chilling effect, I fear, for quite a while.
Yeah, it looks like now it's going to be released on Crackle.
Crackle.
On Christmas Day.
Crackle. Who here has used and seen things on Crackle?
Sometimes I watch the Jerry Seinfeld's Comedians in Cars thing.
I'm pretty sure that I saw one movie on Crackle like 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
There were commercials, I feel, in the middle of it. I can't remember.
Mm.
Who knows? But, you know, we might get to see an interview, but it is a little weird that it happened at all. It's a strange situation. Danny King, did you have any thoughts on this thing?
I don't really have anything to add, honestly. I sort of agree with what's been said.
Were you looking forward to the interview? Like, was
no,
it really,
I wasn't. And it's sort of, it's weird that it never, I mean, I've seen that trailer so many times and it just never struck me as something that would have such a huge, like, impact. I was sort of getting ready for it to just, like, come and go.
And
obviously that's not going to happen, so.
Nope. Oh, man. Maybe Crackle hacked Sony. No one knows about us, but if we can get a big release, we might be able to do something with this shit we've got on our hands. Okay, well, that's about that. I don't want to go into, I don't know, they could talk about what the emails reveal about Hollywood's view of itself or people within it or race or sex or anything like that, but
who cares?
There's a lot of stuff out there about that that'll say it a lot better than we can. Other thing that happened, we got a couple of trailer releases. Jurassic World happened, as well as the new Star Wars episode
seven.
Okay. Oops. So Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens. Brouhaha's about all those. Any thoughts in particular on those trailers, gentlemen? Neither of these movies will be out for at least 6 to 7 months.
Force Awakens looks really pretty.
It does. It's a pretty looking film.
Yeah, cinematographically, I was very impressed. I am glad that it's going to... I'm sure it'll be a nice looking thing, and as long as it's not so like horrifically, abjectly stupid, I'm sure the experience of watching it will be fine. But I don't know. It's also, I mean, it's total fan service from top to bottom, and I guess it has to be. because you want to, but it, you know, it's like, it's Stormtrooper, speeder craft, X-Wing, lightsaber, Millennium Falcon. Okay.
Yeah, that's the whole trailer you just said.
Right.
Oh, you forgot soccer ball droid.
Soccer ball droid, right. And then the Jurassic World I just thought looked like abysmal, and I don't know.
Earnestly excited for Jurassic World.
Okay.
Chris Pratt leading velociraptors on a hunt on a motorbike. I am sold.
Whatever.
Sold.
I have no attachment to the Jurassic Park series. Because I'm a huge Spielberg fan, and I think Jurassic Park is actually kind of like a mid to lower tier Spielberg myself.
Okay.
It's not a movie that has really ever, I like it fine, but it's not a movie that's ever really set my world on fire. So the trailer was just kind of a dud.
Right.
So there were those two, but who cares? Because we also got...
May I say it?
I suppose you can.
Knight of Cups, trailer for the newest Terrence Malick.
Oh, what?
What are you talking about?
Oh, I thought you were talking about what is it, the Hot Tub Time Machine 2?
Oh, I didn't even see that.
Or The Gunman with Sean Penn?
Oh, I watched The Gunman trailer.
Okay. Well, I'm very upset at the turn this has taken. What is The Gunman even about?
Oh, it's like...
What it sounds like.
Sean Penn is like a spy.
Sean Penn uses a gun. That's weird. I thought he only did important movies with a social message.
We'll see. Maybe it will be.
Maybe it's going to be like that. What was that, Snitch with The Rock?
Oh, yeah. That was stunningly social message driven.
Anyway, yeah. So Knight of Cups, the newest trailer for the newest film by Terrence Malick, which will be premiering at the Berlin International Film Festival.
All those years, living the life of someone I didn't even know.
Let me tell you about you. I want to make you rich.
You see the palm trees? They tell you anything's possible.
No one cares about reality anymore.
Yeah.
Holy shit. This looks really good. And not like most anything we've seen from Malick previously, and not just because, again, it's one in modern day, but I mean like some of the images you were seeing, the music in the background, and
GoPros.
Guys. Oh my god,
GoPro party footage.
Fuck yeah,
yeah.
I'm excited.
I can't wait. I just, you know, doesn't have U.S. distribution yet, but I imagine after its premiere in Berlin, it'll pick up someone, even if it's like a small company like Magnolia again or whatever.
Yeah,
they did a pretty good job distributing to the Wonder, so
yeah,
I think
well,
I can't wait. It's exciting, and it's also just, I had a fun thing where there were like three people who I showed the trailer to without telling them what it was. So when the written and directed by Terrence Malick credit came up amidst flashes of like dancing women, like the opening shot of Miami Vice or something, the look on their faces was so great. I showed it to a friend of mine. He's usually a very even-keeled, sober kind of guy. And he just sort of like, his jaw dropped and he went, "What?" when that came on. He was very confused what I was showing him. He just saw Christian Bale and like parties. He said, "Why am I watching?" And he went, "Oh, God." So that was fun.
That does sound pretty awesome.
Watching it was like, you know, Jordan Raup, editor-in-chief, sent me the link to it. And, you know, I didn't hear any other reactions to it. So it was a real total surprise. And,
what did I do? I just opened up the YouTube link, and like the person I had clicked on it from initially, they just had the word Terrence Malick repeated on their tweet over and over and over again. So I was like, oh shit, I don't even care. And then I read the write-up on our site, and, you know, I looked at a couple of other places. You know, and then I started tweeting out a barrage of, like, my wish fulfillment, like, titles of articles that would be hitting the internet all day.
Yeah.
Like, 7 things we learned from the Knight of Cups trailer, 4 questions we have about the Knight of Cups trailer. But, unfortunately, none of those came to pass. Not as important to the world, apparently, as Star Wars Episode 7, The Force Awakens.
I know, this one actually asks us to ponder the difference between strawberries and raspberries.
Yeah, they're like flavors.
What's funny is this class, I was taking a course where we watched all of Malick's films in a row. And so it ended a few days before this trailer came out with To the Wonder. And the course concluded with the professor who's like, he's like a Malick nut who's in his 70s or something. So he has like vivid memories of when he saw like everyone for the first time. And so he like ended the course with, you know, I hope we get another Malick film to talk about next year. I know he's making one about like the country music scene. And he just like this sort of really like vague like optimism. And then a few days later, I see this film stage headline that's like bass heavy, party filled first trailer. And I just like wish I could have seen his first reaction to like that headline, or even just wondering if he's watched the trailer. Because I mean, the other thing is most of the kids in the class did not like To the Wonder at all. So I know right when this trailer hit, I sent the link to a bunch of them, because it's obviously like the best possible thing that could happen to try to convert someone who didn't like To the Wonder, like just a minute that looks like Miami Vice basically. So that, I thought that was really fun, and yeah, I'm looking forward to it. At the same time though, it's clearly seems like in the same style as, you know, his recent films. So
I wouldn't recent film like isn't To the Wonder.
Sure.
I didn't see a lot of Tree of Life in it, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, probably more To the Wonder. But just that there are probably scenes that if you didn't like To the Wonder, it seems like this isn't like a complete 180. But
yeah. Actually, I'll take that back. There was a little bit of Tree of Life in all the beach scenes.
Maybe that was it.
Man loves the beach.
I think the shift in location is very notable.
Yeah.
In particular, I actually kind of posted this little like, this little jabby photo juxtaposition where I said, IDK is Malick making the same images over and over. And it was a shot of like Jessica Chastain pointing to the sky, holding her son, the Tree of Life, with Christian Bale in a nightclub, Night of Cups. That to me is really fascinating. I think that the shift to a place like Los Angeles, modern Los Angeles, will do quite a bit for him. I think there are shots that look like maybe Las Vegas, perhaps. Mm. There are a couple of shots there that don't seem to fit LA, as at least what I know of LA. So
yeah, that's a good point.
But but it's interesting because the shots in the second half that very much recall To the Wonder, I feel like we're sort of, for me, have sort of been colored by what comes in the first half, knowing that there's going to be this very intense juxtaposition going on in the film, or at least assuming there will be.
Yeah.
I feel like my rewatch of To the Wonder this time last year was a very good thing for my Malick love. Not that it was really deeply adversely affected by my initial distaste for To the Wonder, but just like watching it again, I'm so ready for his next current film.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. It's a very exciting prospect. Yeah, hopefully it's not too long a wait. I mean, it's very possible that it'll, you know, maybe they'll do like a Tree of Life thing for all we know.
Where it's going to take 7 years to come out?
No. Like in terms of release, like they put it out in late May or something. That would be great.
I would hope so. I want it as soon as possible. Goddamn, just give it to me now. Like I'll do anything. I'll hurt people. You know.
Oh yeah.
It doesn't matter to me. I'm wondering if like it's gonna be something where like they have all that music in the trailer, but then like in those party scenes, it's just gonna be like Mozart or Bach just playing.
Right.
It'll be fucking awesome if that's what happens.
Did you miss the part where Jason Clarke has his arm around Christian Bale and he's pointing like a gun at him or something?
Really?
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
Like they're like at a party, like they're celebrating, but they're both laughing, his arm around him, and he's pointing like a handgun at his stomach.
See, this is why we need 7 things you didn't notice in the Night of Cups trailer. Well, I want screenshots like that.
I'm just going to go back to this right now. What's also weird is that there's a shot of a little boy on a beach, shot from behind his head, and the colors are extremely saturated.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very strange moment that it's as he's talking about like how he doesn't know who he is anymore.
Right.
And I wonder if that's like a flashback.
A flashback to him as a kid. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm assuming there's going to be shit like that.
See, it's so easy to overanalyze this because it's like it's very
everything is disconnected. The synopsis that they gave out with the trailer was like a one-line recitation of like a story about someone going to Egypt or something.
It was weird.
It was really weird, but it's awesome.
And it features the voice of Ben Kingsley. I wonder if Ben Kingsley will voice Bale's father. See?
The tree that the father planted in the front yard. Voiced by Ben Kingsley. Yeah, I don't know. I'm excited. I'm really excited.
No, I can't wait.
God damn. What was the thing the guy said in the beginning, too? Is like, let me tell you about you. I'm going to rake you a rich man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Nobody cares about reality anymore.
It's true. It's goddamn true. Whew. I cannot wait for that goddamn movie. It looks...
I honestly feel like Malick in his current form is actually perfect to shoot like a party scene.
Yeah.
I feel like there is... Yeah. I actually feel like there is something very... The Lubezki touch... I feel like it, you know, I thought actually in Birdman, Lubezki was like almost a little constricted shooting, just these very kind of like spare sets. I feel like a crowded party. Oh, and also, by the way.
I just imagine like a Steadicam shot. Like in To the Wonder, the camera was constantly moving and it was moving into things and like really tight close-ups on stuff. And like that's how you walk through a party.
Yeah.
Is like shoving past these people and catching like out of the corner of your eye random shit that's happening.
So I have to point out, I'm not so sure now this is a handgun. It just kind of looks like something somebody would be shot by the cops for holding, and then turns into a handgun. But in the background of the shot, next to Christian Bale is Thomas Lennon, best known as Lieutenant Jim Dangle from Reno 911.
Seriously?
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah, that's kind of cool.
I'm excited. I will say, like, so if I had to choose like a couple words to describe this trailer, I would say beautiful, obviously, kinetic, sexy, which is something that you wouldn't really think you'd hear about a Terrence Malick film. But there's a real, like, he's taken the sensuality that's usually in his films and kind of, at least in what we're assuming is going to be, like, the opening part of this movie, really infused it with, like, that modern kind of intense, intoxicating conceptualization of human sexuality. It's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
There's someone who says, like, you're not looking for love, you're looking for love experience. There, oh, my God. Fuck yeah. Anyway, any other thoughts on this trailer before we actually talk about a movie?
No. No. I think I'm good.
Cool. Danny?
Cool trailer.
Killer trailer. And you can be damn sure we're going to talk about it at our earliest convenience. The movie, not the trailer. Though, honestly, I could talk about this trailer every day until the movie comes out.
But let's not.
We're not going to. No. We'll revisit once a month.
How has it sat with you in the past month?
Yeah, now that you've had some time to sit with this trailer.
Have you become more of a strawberry or a raspberry man?
Oh, man. So, yeah, that's that. We're now going to talk about our feature film review, which is The Babadook, again, written and directed by Jennifer Kent, and starring Essie Davis and Noah Weissman. This is the story of a single mother raising her seven-year-old son, who is deathly afraid of monsters, and the emotional fallout that occurs after she reads him a strange picture book. Oh boy, that is horrible. Picture book called The Babadook, Mr. Babadook.
Nothing bad's gonna happen, Sam.
Did he think that about my dad before he died?
Who sees things as they are, that one?
I promised to protect you if you promised to protect me.
Oh, my God. Did he hurt anyone?
The boy has significant behavioral problems.
This monster thing has got to stop, all right? It's just a book. It can't hurt you.
Here's the trailer. All right, so The Babadook. Don't call it a horror movie. That's what I've heard from the director, I believe. It is kind of scary, though. But it's definitely
sort of a horror movie.
certainly has the trappings of a horror movie to tell a very dramatic, thriller-esque story. So let's not listen to what the author says, because, as we all know, the death of the author is a thing. Let's tell you what we thought of it. Danny King, what were your thoughts on The Babadook?
I liked The Babadook for the most part. I think we all watched it online, which probably not ideal for a movie like this, which, you know, is often kind of dark visually and just stuff like that. But I like the movie. It's sort of interesting the way it's structured, where it begins as a movie that you think is about this demonic kid, and then halfway through it kind of becomes about the demonic mother. And I think I sort of prefer the first half for the way it sympathizes with the mother's kind of struggle and the way it situates that within like just real day situations. I thought one of the best scenes in the movie is when she goes to see a doctor to try to see what's wrong with her son. And he suggests that they go to a psychiatrist. And then she asks for pills to help put him to sleep. And there's just a super, I don't know if awkward's not the right word, but just a really revealing moment where she kind of explains why she like really needs the pills, and it's disturbing and relatable. And I think stuff like that was really effective. And Jennifer Kent, first time director, does a lot of things well. I think the editing is pretty crucial in kind of creating the mood of the film, and also the sound design. There are moments when the kid is sort of screaming, and the way it's put together in montage, you really are kind of aligned with the mother pretty strongly, and it's annoyingly effective.
that is so well put.
Yeah. I mean, there are shots of her. It seemed like there were a couple of them where she's driving the car and her face is like in close up. And then you just have the kid yelling in the back seat. And it's like, you just feel for her so strongly. And I was really into that. And when the shift happens and when she starts becoming the one that's kind of affected by this pop-up book, which, by the way, is really well designed.
I want to buy that book.
Yeah. Like,
I want to read it to my nephew.
Are they for sale?
They made like a limited between 2,000 and 5,000 copy thing of it.
Oh my god.
Okay. Might be a little pricey, but you can get one for your nephew or something.
That would do that in a heartbeat.
Yeah, I mean, it was cool to be thrown back to like just a time when like this book is like actually creepy as fuck and there's like nothing. I mean, it's edited really quickly when they show you kind of the text of the book, but it's really just the design of it is terrifying, and you can get why it kind of possesses the kid like that. But as I was saying, I think when the mother sort of becomes the one that's taken over by it, the movie is maybe a little bit more hit and miss for me. I think it's always fun from a genre standpoint and entertaining. But we can probably, I don't know how much of this is considered spoilers, but it's just kind of like metaphorically blunt. And Nick had a pretty funny tweet about that, so I'm sure he can say more about kind of how maybe over-explained some of the movie's scares are, which would probably be my main drawback with the film. But overall, I liked it. And if I don't think it's quite as strong as some of the hype it's getting, I think it's still a good horror movie, and I would recommend it.
So I'm just going to say this. You have 30 days to pre-order a Mr. Babadook book. It is $80. It is $60 for the book.
Oh wow!
With $20 flat rate shipping to anywhere in the world.
It's handmade.
It is handmade. The first 2,000 will be signed and numbered. Unfortunately, damn. And then it says news update: all books sold during this campaign will be signed by writer director Jennifer Kent.
Yeah.
Books will ship in mid-2015, and your cards will be charged immediately upon placing.
Signing 8,000 copies. Jesus.
It's only 3,451 so far.
Okay.
But
that's like more work than making a movie.
It definitely seems like it could be. I get paid tomorrow. I may be buying a Babadook book.
Okay.
Yeah, because as Danny said, this is a creepily effective thing. And it's not like a phaser. Like, it's gonna be as creepy as it was in the movie. Oh my god, so fucking creepy. They have pictures. Anyway. Danny, were you done?
I think I'm done for the time being. Yeah.
Nick Newman, what about yourself? What did you think of The Babadook?
Well, I guess let's clear the elephant in the room, and I can sort of read the tweet that I composed, but I also composed it because I'm an asshole. I decided to compose it with every word misspelled. So if you go to twitter.com/Nick_Newman/stats/54653434679108812 9, you can read it. Also, I'll read it out in sort of the phonetic way. Do any you guys think the Babadook is a metaphor? So I tweeted this within minutes of finishing the film.
You consummate asshole.
And I, you know, watching it, I kind of did the thing where I unplugged the Christmas tree lights, I turned off the living room lights, turned off the outside porch light, put up the sound, was ready to be scared. And then for whatever reason, the film had really no in-the-moment effect on me. I found really none of it scary, really no inch of it scary for some reason. I don't know. I can't qualify this or quantify it or anything like that. I can't pinpoint why that is, because that is such a specific thing. The same way I can't tell you why, you know, why I find something funny. Like, that, it's a difficult thing to do. Right, and simple. I guess I'll just say that part of the reason I kind of come on the negative side of the Babadook is because I think that it's sort of too clean, I think. It feels very one note in the sense that it is kind of even when it's not in the scare-a-minute mode, it is kind of playing in a single register, which is a register I really don't care for, which is like very, you know, very unpleasant domestic life, screaming, yelling, telling your child you hate them, child always yelling. The child performance in this is exactly the kind of child performance I can't stand. And that's that might speak to my general distaste for children, but it was, yeah, I mean, in the moment, it was kind of not having much of an effect on me. And in the less than 24 hours since I've seen it, my opinion of it has only deteriorated not to the extent that I hate this film. I don't think this is a terrible film. I'm not even sure how much it's a bad film necessarily. I just found it relatively ineffective in everything it was trying to do, which actually makes it sound fucking awful. but I don't think it is. I just found that as a piece of horror filmmaking, really the only thing it left me to chew on was some interesting formal qualities. I was impressed with the way that Kent was able to communicate the sense of a manic life that is kind of just flittering by minute, which is very much comes through in the cutting of the film and these time lapses she employs that I think are very effective. And
yeah,
really one of the only creepy moments in the film is a time lapse involving darkness turning to light above a sheet that is over the camera.
Yeah.
That was really one of the elements in the film that I found to hit me in any sort of way. And then, I don't know, otherwise, it's not a matter of the film explaining itself so much as it's just very clear. I mean, you don't have a character masturbate and then right at the moment of climax have the monster make its first appearance and not have that be a very obvious connotation. I have the significance be very clearly pointed. Mm-hmm. And
was it when the monster showed up?
Well, not when the monster shows up, but when it makes its first, when its presence is first made known, I will say.
Okay.
I'll say that. Right. A very deliberate crashing sound that is going on and some very clearly stated, very clearly communicated camera work going on there. And yeah, as a whole, the film just kind of left me sitting unsatisfied, wishing for a bit more. I know that doesn't really sound like very biting criticism, but it's also because the film is, the Babadook has left me feeling a little blank overall. And I was very surprised when I looked up after I saw the film, and I understand this is not necessarily the best policy, but I was surprised when I looked this film up and I saw it as a 98% on Rotten Tomatoes. And I was looking over some of the reviews and I get it. I get where the appeal of this might lie, but if you, like me, were not moved by it in the sense that you want to be moved by it, you want to be jolted out of your seat a bit, there's really only a few things to admire. I thought Essie Davis's performance was strong, if not requiring her to basically do variations on the same theme from minute 1 to minute 90. But that's not so much her fault as it is the fault of Jennifer Kent, who I don't think really wrote something that plays in many registers. And again, the registers it plays in are kind of only intermittently interesting. It sounds like I really hate this film. I don't. I'm just very cold on it overall. I think it is a well-composed, well-edited piece of work. Mm-hmm. And I think that there is some good sound design going on. But I wonder what it's in service of. So there you have it.
So did you ever find out, is the Babadook a metaphor? Because I'd be interested to hear.
I think it might be.
No, as the movie was finishing, I thought to myself, I have a lot of friends who've recently given birth or are pregnant. I guess that's just the stage in my life that I'm at now.
Given birth to and are pregnant with human children, right?
Yes.
Okay.
To the best of my knowledge.
All right.
The children that have been born so far have been human. I will not speak with any certainty as the ones that will be born, because I never like to speak with certainty on anything. Except for how terrible The Hobbit probably is. So, I was thinking to myself, like, any time that one of my friends has, like, a problem with their child, or is like, I can't stand this kid, I'm going to call that, you know, they're having a Babadook. Or, like, you know, that's a medical condition called Babadook. When you fucking hate your child and want to destroy them. I like this movie. I will agree that I guess it wasn't... When William Friedkin says that your movie is, like, the scariest thing he's ever seen, it sets a high bar. And it's not the movie's fault for not clearing that bar, because I don't know what scares William Friedkin. However, I was a little more into the movie towards the beginning, when things were at their most ambiguously crazy. This is actually a child performance that I can get behind at the same time that it annoys the hell out of me. Because they want this kid to be a terrible, terrible child. And he does it. I mean, he goes for it. And he is just so real world pain in the ass that I wanted to throttle him. And I guess that's what we're supposed to get out of it. But his performance weighted against the performance of Essie Davis, I mean, it was heartbreaking and frustrating to watch, which is what the movie was going for. So the movie made me feel a lot of very uncomfortable emotions regarding my wishes towards the welfare of a child. But it was effective, so I have to give it props for that. And as time went on, I think that the movie lost a little bit of its momentum. And some of what occurred was kind of easy to guess at from the book itself. You can kind of figure it out, you know. But I really liked it anyway. I enjoyed it. It flew by, which is, you know, even though I could tell that it had some tonal pacing and story issues, the fact that it was still moving at a hefty clip and when it was over, I was like, oh, wow, shit, it's over. I was impressed. I was impressed by it. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to quantify spoilers in this. I'm sure we can talk about it more when we do eventually just say, whatever, screw it, spoilers. But in general, I thought, you know, it was beautifully composed. I liked the camera work, the lighting effects. I think that Essie Davis is pretty much perfect in this. She doesn't really strike a wrong note. It's harder for me to judge the kids' acting. But yeah, given how much I hated him, I think he did a very good job. He's like the 6 to 7 year old version of the bad guy from Ghostbusters / Die Hard, who is not one of the guys that you're like looking to get shot or spirit trapped at the end. You know the character actor I'm talking about. He was the dick in all the 80s movies.
Yes, I do.
Yeah,
with the red hair.
Yeah, red-haired dude.
That guy is not
EPA and a news organization in general.
Let's just be clear: he was not the guy in Die Hard. However,
he wasn't.
No, it was a different guy.
It was not a different guy.
It 100% was.
No, it wasn't.
I'm gonna find this right now.
I'm looking it up. I'm looking it up. So,
what is the guy's name? I don't know what his fucking name is. Harry Ellis. Yeah,
Harry Ellis. Guy,
okay, that's Hart Bachner.
Who? What?
That's the guy's name. Hart Bachner plays Harry, the guy with the mustache beard.
No, not the Coke dude.
And William Atherton.
Dude. William Atherton plays both the guys I'm talking about.
I thought you were talking about the... Disregard.
Okay, all right. Well, I was technically correct, but I could understand where you get it wrong. No, not the Cokehead guy who tries to cut a deal. The guy who, like, threatens the
right.
McLean's babysitter with deportation. Yeah, William Atherton. William Atherton, you hate him. He comes on the screen and you hate him, and you want him to fail. But it's not because he's a bad actor, it's because he's a great actor at playing shitty characters. And this little kid has that same kind of thing to him. So, yeah, The Babadook. An effective, interesting, constantly engaging film that has a couple of issues, but in general I found to be very, very, very good. So we just we all kind of seem to be saying the same thing. does anyone have any, like, contrary opinions to air? Anyone want to specifically attack any of the things that anyone else said? Or just, like, really dive into the symbolism?
I'd just say I think Nick made a comment about S.C. Davis's performance that sort of, a lot of it's, like, variations on the same theme, I think. Mm-hmm. And I would agree that, you know, by the end of the film, what's sort of driving her character throughout is made really clear. But I still think within the context of individual scenes, like a lot of the things she's doing are sort of insanely different and like extreme. You know, like one scene she's the kind of like nice mother that's stressed out, and then 30 minutes later she's like something out of a
Stephen King novel.
Sure, or something. Yeah, like something that's blood is flying out of her mouth, or things like this. So I think like the performance sort of keeps me involved because I always felt like there was an emotional core to it, and that's actually sort of the trade-off with like the monster's presence being explained so explicitly. Is like on the one hand, it maybe makes the movie less terrifying because the source of it is really explained, but it is also nice to be able to just have like complete access to her psychology and know why the things are happening the way they're happening. And so I think that's sort of like maybe a decision that Kent just made, and that's how she wanted to sort of approach this story.
Mm-hmm. And I thought like this is one of those films where I just like was looking at her. I was like, they must have just kept her awake during the entire shoot, because she plays tired with frayed nerves to the hilt. And you know, when you're in that kind of state, I mean, every reaction you're having is still coming from that same well of exhaustion and uncertainty and anger. And so I found the fact that she was able to find different notes within that same octave to be really impressive, and she knew which ones to play at which points.
Yeah. One other small funny thing is there's I think she works at like a nursing home or something like that, and one of her coworkers is this guy who's played by an actor named Daniel Henshaw. Mm-hmm. And he a couple of years ago was in this really brutal film called The Snowtown Murders, where he played a serial killer. And so, and that performance was like really left an impression on me. And so when he showed up as like the sort of nice coworker who's like giving her presents, I sort of expected, I mean, I actually didn't expect him to be a mean character, but I was just like, had a hard time not remembering him as this like psychopathic killer. So when he shows up at her house with gifts, I was like,
oh shit.
Yeah.
Okay, well, that's that. We're going to talk about spoilers now, so feel free to use the chapter select arrows at the bottom of your player to skip past that. I hope that works. No one's told me it hasn't, so either no one's paying attention anyway, or it's working flawlessly. So spoilers for The Babadook. There's a point in this movie where this woman, Essie, who's being played by Essie Davis, the character's name is Amelia, I don't think we've actually said that yet, she's talking to her sister, and she says something along the lines of, like, talking about the death of her husband, who was killed in a car accident while driving her to the hospital to have their child, Samuel. She says, like, I am over the death of my husband. I don't talk about him. You know, I don't bring him up. I don't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it is funny how that, you know, just shutting the fuck up about someone that you've lost is in our modern culture kind of synonymous with getting over them. Mm-hmm. And how you feel like a burden when you bring it up, and that leads to a lot of issues. I have gone through this personally. And it's a rough situation. It's a rough scenario. And so lines like that in this movie, and coupled with her performance, helped to sell me on the manifestation of the Babadook, which is definitely metaphorical, but at the same time is literal in the world of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Am I like I'm not everyone agrees with me on that, right? That while this is a metaphor in the movie, there is actually a literal monster.
Seems to be the case.
Okay.
Sure.
Because there was a point where I was wondering in this film, like, is it just a metaphor? Like, is this just going to be the story of a woman who has snapped and is going to kill her child? Which is pretty dark. I don't know how I feel about the fact that they actually made it a real monster.
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone have any thoughts on that? Like, would you have preferred if they didn't have the really creepy ending scene where everything seems fine? Her and her son have really settled down, and he seems to be well-adjusted, and she seems to be a lot more present. And then she brings a bowl of, like, worms and bugs downstairs for this ethereal shadow creature to feast upon.
Yeah, that was dark.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was sort of, in the last few minutes, I was sort of waiting for, like, a Carrie-type ending or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And this was different.
Spoilers for Carrie.
I mean, I guess.
I'm joking.
It's pretty vague, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, because that's what I was thinking. Like, that whole last scene where everything's sunshine and rainbows and her son are so much better now, and she's able to say that her son is like her husband, and then he's doing magic and she's watching, and they're all laughing and having a good time and talking about his birthday, was lit. My heart was pounding throughout that whole scene. Because there was something so unwholesome about how wholesome they were being.
Mm-hmm.
While they have this presence in the basement that they're feeding and that the kid wants to see, but that she says she'll have to wait until he's older to really go for. So in that moment, is the creature in the basement still functioning as a metaphor for the pain and sorrow of loss? And the fact that you don't just board it up and try to ignore it, but that you feed it in a healthy way and share that responsibility with someone you love?
That's, yeah, pretty damn near.
Okay.
What my impression was.
I don't like going for consensus on a metaphorical movie, but I would like to know that my thoughts on it are not completely insane. So I'm glad you agree, Danny. Nick Newman, what about yourself? What did you think?
Yeah, sure. I just
okay.
Not to dismiss your, I don't care. Like, I thought that the movie kind of announced itself as, when I say I don't care, it's not that I don't care what you're reading, I just don't care to really discuss it.
Okay.
Because I feel like the movie announced itself as saying what it needed and wanted to say kind of early on.
Mm-hmm.
Again, masturbation related to the appearance of the monster, and then
so you
the whole
think
talk
it was
about
all sexual frustration?
Well, that coincide with the fact that the monster now resides in the same place where she saw the visions of her dead husband.
And kept all of his stuff.
It just kind of, I don't know. It's just, it's one of those things where, this is like, you know, if in one of my cinema studies classes we're discussing a film afterward, this is the kind of question where I just kind of keep my head down and just pretend to write something in my notebook. so I don't have to bring it up.
I'm just curious because you really have latched on to the masturbation part, and I didn't...
Oh, I always latch on to the masturbation parts of anything.
Yeah, well, I mean, that says something. I didn't really think about that throughout the course of the movie. I thought that was just like, she can't sleep. She can't even work a full day. Her son is getting kicked out of school. And on top of it all, she can't, you know, have a relationship or even approximate one with a vibrator. I mean, it was like, there are all so many kinds of frustration that she's going through that for you to latch on to the lack of an orgasm, it strikes me as something that maybe I don't actually want to read more into.
You're always welcome to.
I'm
right here.
I think I'm fine. I'm just going to say I said it. I said what I had to say. I'm done with that.
One thing
it is something for our listeners to think about. Write in podcast@thefilmstage.com telling us what you think about Nick's fixation on Amelia trying to masturbate.
Yeah, no, to switch gears. one thing that is sort of a key part of the movie that we haven't mentioned is like the TV in their house,
mm-hmm.
Which I think among other things plays a lot of like clips from George Méliès films.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, that was creepy, but I don't know. Did you guys have any reaction to that stuff?
Thing about TVs and movies where none of them seem to be hooked up to our modern 2000 channel cable boxes.
I mean, their whole house seems like out of time.
This is true.
But
in almost any movie, a person will still like flip through channel by channel because it's not compelling to watch someone, you know, stuck on HGTV while they're scrolling through a list of the 40 different HBOs. Also, in any movie at any time, you can turn on the TV and see an old horror movie.
Yeah.
So I didn't like the fact that it held on to that kind of cliche, but I did like how you could see its effect on her and the fact that they were Méliès movies. You know, that was kind of cool.
And when she gets the book back and it's like the throat slit or something.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that was nuts.
I wonder how they're going to do that in the book that I'm ordering.
Yeah, I was like, wow.
Yeah,
I could see why she got scared.
Anyway, so yeah, that's. I think that's. Oh my god, I'm thinking of also of when the little pop-up book she strangles the dog to death.
God, yeah.
Oh fuck. Anyway, so yeah, there's a lot of disturbing, interesting imagery in this film. It works for some of us better than for others. I would say definitely seek it out. It's currently on VOD and in limited release. And yeah, that's about it. So let's talk about what's going to be coming to DVD and Blu-ray now. We've missed a couple of weeks, so we missed things like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, The Maze Runner, and Guardians of the Galaxy, and When the Game Stands Tall, and Calvary, and Frank. But let's just stick with talking about what's coming out this week, 23rd of December. The Trip to Italy, The Good Lie, starring Reese Witherspoon, Pride. That's about it. Any of these striking your fancy, gentlemen?
Oh yeah, there's really not that much.
No, not
much
outside The Trip to Italy. I don't know what any of these films are, so
I'm aware of the fact that there was a Reese Witherspoon thing called The Good Lie. I saw a poster for it when I was in Toronto, but I don't know if it was playing at Toronto or if it had just been at that theater.
Can you confirm that it actually exists?
Yes, I can. I have seen it in an outside place. Pride, actually, I believe was about gay rights activists siding with the striking minors in Thatcher era England, and stars at least Paddy Considine. I know that much, and it's supposed to be very good. I have not seen it. I cannot actually give you any firm first person account for its quality, but yeah, it's supposed to be good, and that one did play at Toronto, if my memory serves correctly. It also stars Dominic West and Bill Nighy.
Such Good Friends is a Preminger film.
Okay.
That is suddenly of interest. I didn't know that.
All right. Well, then let's talk about what's coming out to theaters this Christmas week. We have Unbroken, the newest film by director Angelina Jolie. Who is definitely not known for other things as well. I guess I could have said that she was the actress, but nah, fuck it. This is a story of a Olympian who is in World War II and is in a war camp and remains unbroken by the experience. We also have Into the Woods, the adaptation of the Sondheim musical. We have The Gambler, which stars Mark Wahlberg. We also have Selma, which is hitting limited release before it goes wide later next year. Well, later next year, like first or second week of next year. And this is a dramatic retelling of Martin Luther King Jr. and the rights on Selma, Alabama. The rights on Selma, Alabama. The March for Civil Rights on Selma, Alabama. We also have in limited release American Sniper, the newest film by Clint Eastwood. That is about the Navy SEAL sniper Chris Kyle, who is purportedly the most lethal sniper in American history. We also have Big Eyes hitting limited release. That is directed by Tim Burton.
And a lot of films.
What? Yeah, there's a lot of films hitting limited because they're trying to get in under the wire for Oscars, but apparently none of them wanted to go wide. We also have 2 Days, 1 Night, the newest film by the Dardenne brothers. That stars Marion Cotillard. And finally, something called Beloved Sisters. I don't know. I don't know what this is about. Anyway, have we heard anything about any of these? Do we want to see any of them? Let's find out. Nick, Danny, want to throw out your picks amongst the litter?
2 days, one night, I've seen, and it's really good.
It's by the Dardenne brothers, I should say. Yeah,
Marion Cotillard gives two of the best female performances of the year between this and The Immigrant.
Goddamn right.
Yeah, The Immigrant, man. And then American Sniper is also really good. And I'm curious to perhaps see it again if we talk about it maybe in the new year.
I do want to talk about that one. As a person who used to hold ambitions of being a sniper, I would be interested to see it.
No.
What? That's not a secret. I've said that before.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I feel like I did. Anyway, okay. Well, that's now we know for certain.
Now I'm even more curious to discuss the film.
Yes.
And I also love the original version of The Gambler, so I'll probably check out the new one out of curiosity, even though I think it's gotten some mixed reviews.
Okay. Nick Newman, any of these?
I have seen, I think, 2 Days, One Night twice, actually. I saw it once at a press screening, and then it was playing at my school as part of this series that they do, and I took the opportunity to see it again because I liked it so much, and I still liked it very much. It's very good. I am a fan of the Dardenne brothers normally, but rarely react to one of their films sort of with such as strongly as I did this one. This movie really, really touched me the way I wasn't expecting. We'll get to that later. I think it's a very intelligently handled film, more than just classic melodramatic weepy. So there's that, and then American Sniper I'm looking forward to as well. You know, the brief preview of it, I've only seen the like 1 minute preview, which I thought was quite impressive, and I know Danny likes it. I am generally an Eastwood fan, so the prospect of that is enticing, especially in what I think is a pretty dry end of year award season kind of thing. That is the only Oscar contender, Oscar Bates, what have you, thing that I actually want to see. So I guess maybe it might shine a little brighter than normal because it's this thing at the multiplex that I think will actually have a chance of being very good. So is that. The Gambler, who cares? the rest of them, who cares? I don't, certainly. But, yeah, I don't know. This is a good time to stay in and do catch up for my 2014 list and see a lot of good things that weren't going to play alongside The Gambler.
Well, I definitely want to see Selma. Based on the trailer, it seems
And Selma, that might be good too.
Yeah, it's just based on the trailer, it looks like it's going to be like the anathema, I think I'm using the right word there, to a lot of the historic docs that I'm used to seeing. I'm thinking like things like 42 or the James Brown one that I can't remember.
Biopics?
Yeah, but I'm sorry about, like, I can't remember the name of the James Brown biopic.
Get On Up.
Yeah, that's the one.
Yeah.
A lot of those seem like they're running the same thing. Selma seems like it's coming from a different place artistically, and I think it's gonna be a stellar-looking film. It actually seems like it's got some ferocity behind it, which I think is what you need to bring to something like that, and not Harrison Ford saying, "I want someone who has the courage not to fight back." So that definitely I'm looking forward to. American Sniper, like I said, I'm looking forward to it. I don't know, I haven't heard a lot of good things, but Danny, you seem to be a fan, so hopefully
you'll like it.
Hopefully we can trust you. Big Eyes, no curiosity about whatsoever. Tim Burton has burned that bridge. 2 Days, One Night, obviously, I'm looking forward to. And that's it. That's it. Everything else, who knows. But I'm going to be in Houston when all these things are hitting. And I have no idea if any of them will actually be there.
Oh, wow. Thanks for letting us know your vacation plans. I'm really glad.
Fuck yourself.
Sorry.
Dick. So the thing is, even if I was still in D.C., I don't think any of these would be around.
It was so totally uncalled for.
Yeah. Asshole.
Which is why it's even funnier.
I think Selma, shocked.
I think Selma actually will be in D.C. I don't think it's going to be in Houston, though. So, like, I rarely travel, and now that I am, I'm going to miss something we might have been able to talk about. Anyway, we'll figure out what we're talking about next week. For the time being, let's talk about something that we've seen personally within the last 2 or 3 weeks or however long we've been gone, and then we can get out of the way. So let's, fuck it. Nick, you start us off. What is something you've seen that you think we should check out?
I have not seen much really since Thanksgiving, because I went back to school and I had end of semester work to do. So that's kind of been on my mind. I don't know. What will I recommend? There's this great film called Vengeance is Mine by Shohei Imamura, Japanese filmmaker from 1979, that is one of the better revenge tales I've seen in really quite some time. Very delicately balanced study of both the need for revenge and the circumstances that go into needing it in the first place, and the guilt that can come with it, the guilt that can sort of splinter out from one's own actions into the lives of everyone who you affect by killing another person. And it's also fun too. It's more fun. It's more fun than that sounds. It has a very, sharp-edged quality to it. It has a very distinctly Japanese character, I think.
Okay.
That not quite like Why Don't You Play in Hell or something, which we talked about in the show, but it has, it has a very Eastern sense of depicting violence and its consequences. It's great. So go watch it.
All right. Nick Newman, what about yourself? I mean, Danny King.
Nick Newman, what did you
Nick Newman do it again. Danny King, what about yourself?
Here we get a Nick Newman. sorry. I felt like doing that. Yeah, so speaking of films about gambling, there is currently a Robert Altman retrospective happening at MoMA, and one of the sort of films that a lot of people recommend that's maybe not as well-known as some of his most famous films is California Split, which stars Elliot Gould and George Segal as two gamblers that sort of meet up. And it kind of tracks their compulsive, you know, relationship to gambling. It's very funny. Altman's style, as you can imagine, works really well in a kind of casino environment where with the overlapping dialogue. And there's an amazing scene where George Segal is getting ready to sit down at a table, and Elliot Gould goes one by one with each player at the table, just filling out their history as a player. And it's, I mean, like, he doesn't know this stuff, so this is just his reading of these men from, like, the first time he sees them, and it's just hilarious the way he pinpoints each of their styles just by looking at them. And the whole movie is very funny, and it lived up to its reputation, so I would, you know, check it out.
Okay, so I've got a couple things I could talk about. Over Thanksgiving, some channel was having a Jurassic Park marathon. So, Nick, if you think that Jurassic Park is mid to low tier Spielberg, Lost World, not a great film.
Ooh, his worst film.
Yeah.
Of all
the ones I've seen, I'm pretty comfortable saying that is not a good one. I also watched, I guess, most of the third one, which I hadn't seen since it, like, came to theaters.
Mm-hmm.
Holy shit, almost unwatchable. Almost completely unwatchable. And by almost unwatchable, I mean you're able to see it, so I guess that makes it technically watchable. But holy shit.
I did get some amusement from that movie because a friend of mine, his dad is in that movie, and he gets eaten by a dinosaur in it.
Seriously?
So, yeah.
Wait,
yeah.
Which guy?
John Deal is his name.
John Deal, okay.
He's sort of like the meat-headed mercenary guy.
Is he the one who, like, gets eaten right when the plane is about to hit him?
Yes.
Oh my god, that's a fucking amazing.
but having since met him and, like, talked to him, it is very amusing to, like, watch him get eaten by a dinosaur. Like, that's really the most the movie has to offer, honestly. Otherwise I think it's okay as, like, a Saturday morning creature feature.
Yeah,
it's
certainly
preferable to The Lost World's absolutely miserable qualities. That is a miserable movie.
Wait, so you're saying Jurassic Park 3 is better than The Lost World?
Yes, but
oh my god,
specific metric.
Holy shit.
It's not, I mean, it's actually, I think it's a better directed movie, because The Lost World does not feel like it was directed by anybody who gave a shit. And from what I understand, there's also this rumor, mind you, But there's this rumor that David Koepp, the screenwriter of it, along with several other Spielberg films, including the original Jurassic Park, actually directed about half of that movie.
Oh, yeah.
While Spielberg was working on Amistad or whatever.
I thought was it Amistad? I think it might have been Amistad. Yeah.
Yeah.
What I love is as I was watching these things, I was at my grandparents' house, and it was like midnight when Jurassic Park 3 came on. So I just started reading the IMDb like interesting trivia bits, and when David one of them for like the, I think the second or third film was like David Koepp had a fan letter stapled or not stapled probably taped to like the side of his computer when he was writing, and it was a fan who'd said like, "Hey, love the movie, but you waited way too long to show the dinosaurs." And it's just kind of funny because like you can tell that the second two films are in such a hurry to show the dinosaurs that they're like, character development, reasonable reason to be on this island, fuck it, dinosaur. And it's awful. I mean, let's be real here. There is a scene in the third film where Alan Grant is asleep on an airplane and then has a dream where there's a velociraptor on the airplane, and then the velociraptor says, "Alan, wake up." Oh my god.
Yeah.
It's so bad. And then everything just goes to shit so quickly. Any sense of wonder or awe is gone from those films. Yeah, it's unbelievable. Unbelievable some of the shit that you have to see when you're watching these films. I haven't really even meant to talk about them. I was going to really talk about a different film that I'd seen, but let's keep this up. Danny, what were you going to say?
I had a funny experience. I'm pretty sure it was with Lost World recently, where I was in a bar and it was playing on the screen, but like with no sound. So it was in the background, and I hadn't seen this movie, you know, since I was a kid. So I'm watching this one scene and it starts with Jeff Goldblum, like on an island or something. And then the shot pulls back and it's like, he's in the subway system. And that island was like a billboard.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's
and I just turned to my friends and I'm like, this movie's a masterpiece. Like, I don't care what else is in it.
See, that's the Lost World version of the raptor on the airplane.
Yeah. Just like the high point. Oh,
was this on like TNT or something, or was it a DVD?
No, it was.
It was in Videology, so I'm pretty sure they like set it up.
Oh, okay.
Probably. Sure, yeah.
Oh, okay.
I was there last week, and they had on Star Trek Insurrection.
Oh my god,
which I've never seen, but
they're just like,
it was
here's
on,
a shitty
and,
movie. Get drunk.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, and the thing is, like, I like Joe Johnson, who directed Jurassic Park 3. I love The Rocketeer. I thought that Captain America, the first Avenger, was like the best Marvel movie up to that point. And so I was watching this, and I don't know if it was just because of like I was watching it on a TV in standard definition and like maybe they cropped it or something, but I was like, this is just, oh boy. And it's like breathless. It's fucking breathless, guys. It's like, oh god, we've been attacked by a Spinosaur. Uh-oh, there's a T-Rex. Uh-oh, there's a Spinosaur. And then there's Velociraptors. And then there's the Pterodactyls. And then there's other shit. And I'm just like, there's no stopping this. And the movie, I like at that pace, I was like, this movie must be 80 minutes long. Because you just can't keep up that pace. And it reminds me of like a short story I wrote when I was a kid that was literally like that way. Every time that they escaped something, they just went, it was like frying pan, fire, surface of the sun, supernova. It, you know, you can't write a story that way. It was goddamn terrible. Also, I watched Almost Famous again for the first time in a couple years, and that's a great movie, so check that out. It's on Netflix. That's all. Did not expect to talk that much about Jurassic Park series. That's it. So let's tell the fine people at home where we can be found, and then we can get out of here. So, Danny King, where can we find you on the internet?
Thefilmstage.com, Twitter.com/TheKingBulletin, and all over...
Okay. Nick Newman, where can we find you?
Thefilmstage.com, Twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and at one of the Knight of Cups parties.
At one of the Knight of Cups parties?
Yeah.
Is it the one where there's the guy in the skeleton thing where he's getting electrocuted on a chair?
Yes.
All right. Excellent. I look forward to meeting you there. You can find me on Twitter at Brian J. Rowan. You can find me on my personal site, dearfilm.net. I believe that, Danny, are you writing any of the year-end content for the Film Stage?
Yeah, I think Well, I'm going to have a top 10 list.
Okay. Yeah, we're publishing...
You mean the individual ones?
We're publishing a shit ton of stuff over at the film stage that y'all should check out. Best breakthrough actor and actress, best cinematography, movies that were better than you expected. There's a whole slew of stuff over there. It's a fun read. And we're not just one person writing this. We go to the whole team, so you can see our different perspectives on everything.
We are definitely...
What was that?
We are Legion.
We are Legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget.
Only God forgives.
Only God forgives.
Little preview of my 2014 top 10 right there.
that was last year.
Oh, it doesn't matter when the film's that great, does it?
That's true. That was on my top 10. I think it shared a spot with Spring Breakers.
Oh, God.
Everybody, get ready, because we are going to do a top 10 podcast, and it's going to be a fucking nightmare. Find me on Twitter, like I said, Brian J. Rowan, thefilmstage.com, and find me in a word or in a book.